everybody. I'm Karen Hartglass. Thanks for joining me today. What are we talking about? We're talking about food. This is the It's All About Food show. Thanks again and again and again and again for being there and listening and for caring about food, because I think food is the answer to everything when we make the right food choices. Not only that, but can be the most delicious way to make the world a better place. So, we have a great show today. I just know it's going to be great. And my first guest is Dr. Evan Allen. He is a board-certified family physician and also has board certification in obesity medicine. He runs a practice in Henderson, Nevada that focuses on using lifestyle medicine medical techniques combined with modern understanding of biochemistry and physiology to assist patients with reversing metabolic disorders or treating acute and chronic illnesses. He is internationally recognized and has won multiple awards over his career as a physician. His recent book that we will be talking about today, Oversaturated, is about how to discuss dietary fats with patients. He talks about how the common understanding of saturated fats has been manipulated by certain segments of the food industry to favor their products and has resulted in large numbers of misinformation in the nutrition space. The book gives some simple techniques that most healthcare team members can use to emphasize the scientific understanding of saturated fats to their patient population. Welcome, Dr. Evan Allen.
Thank you so much for having me, and I'm really appreciative of the opportunity to talk to you.
I really appreciate you being there, and I'm always so happy when I learn of another medical doctor, a lifestyle medicine doctor who's promoting plant foods. That can't make me happier.
Well, good to hear. I like making you happy.
You've made me happy. And I really enjoyed reading the book, and I'll tell you why. It was very straightforward and easy to understand, which is what we need for everyone, right?
Yeah, and I think this is a topic that is, in fact, easy to understand. And that's why the cover really spoke to me when we first saw it, was because you have the obscuring of what should be very clear by the butter on the cover. You can't quite see it as clearly as you otherwise would, because industry's throwing up a screen of greasy misinformation, which has been, as we documented in the book, taking place for at least the last decade.
Well, I think a lot of my listeners know that we get misinformation just about everything, and it's been going on for, I think, ever since humans stepped foot on this planet. We've been,
for sure,
you know, not really upfront about a lot of things, and that's why we're here where we are today. But food, you know, a lot of people are complaining today about what's going on with our government, and there's a lot of terrible things personally that I think are going on. But if you look at the history with food, this manipulation and this misinformation has been going on in the food sector for a very long time.
Oh, for sure. And I think that the difference that's happened over the last decade is that that industry propaganda has taken on a semi or pseudo-scientific sheen to it. So the industry propaganda was always there, but scientifically there was sort of a pushback that doctors and other medical scientists and researchers would sort of say, well, that's all ridiculous. And even during the time of my obesity board's study course and that sort of thing, approving quotes from people like Gary Taubes or other sort of pro-saturated fat people would show up as part of the, you know, slides between the lectures and things like that. And it was sort of stunning to me to see that. And that's really what motivated me, because then I wanted to go find a book that I could read or recommend to people that would explain a case against saturated fat conclusively. And on Amazon, I found really nothing that was at all recent.
Exactly. So, there are some books that may touch on it, but they don't focus on it like you did.
Yeah. So I felt like there was a real need to have just a simple, readable in an evening treatment that does not in any way exhaustive, because an exhaustive treatment would be a much longer and much more detailed book, but that would give people sort of the lay of the land and understand that there amount of scientific controversy here that's real is minuscule compared to what you would think from reading headlines or just paying tangential attention to what
I know. It's crazy what gets press and what doesn't get press. Now, this book, you have said in the opening, is not about you.
Right.
And it's about educating doctors and patients, and I appreciate that. But just for a moment, can we learn a little bit more about you? Now, you come from, you're a vegetarian, and you come from a family of three generations of vegetarians.
Yeah, my grandmother was vegetarian, my mother's vegetarian, and I am also vegetarian. But I was a poster child for sort of bad vegetarianism, where I didn't eat meat or chicken or fish, but I ate loads of cheese and sour cream and butter and eggs and all the, you know, high saturated fat foods that generally replace meat in a typical Western diet if you're not paying close attention. And so even though I didn't consume any saturated fat from actual meats, I had eaten enough to get myself several chronic illnesses and was not doing well. And this is why, you know, it's always remarkable when a study comes out that shows a benefit to a vegetarian diet pattern, which there are several that do, but I'm always sort of stunned by that because you can be very, very unhealthy on a vegetarian diet pattern, and I certainly was. My grandmother also ended up getting dementia.
And my mom had
colon cancer, so, you know, just being vegetarian does not protect you from all the chronic diseases.
Well, we have to say that no one gets out of this world alive.
And that's true.
We live in a very toxic environment.
But we can dramatically reduce the risk.
Yes, we can.
All of those things. And, you know, there's a difference between driving a Pinto down the wrong side of the road and, you know, driving a really nice Volvo with your seatbelt on at the speed.
Absolutely.
And it just
blows my mind why people don't want to live this way. But part of it is because they keep hearing information that isn't true.
Exactly. Yeah. So in 2011, there was sort of a big pushback from industry that focused on a meta-analysis published out of California that was given the cover of Time magazine.
I remember.
And other very prominent placements where essentially, and the statements were couched very carefully in the literature, but in the popular press, they were much, much less nuanced. And in the literature, they said they're not as harmful as we used to think they were. That's all they said.
Mm-hmm.
But in the popular press, it came back, eat as much as you want, it doesn't harm your health at all, which is not what the article said, but that's certainly what industry wanted. And that actually became sort of the de rigueur opinion on the part of even what were, I thought, fairly skeptical medical professionals and people who write in the nutrition space, where the general opinion was that, well, saturated fat's not really a nutrient we should worry about at all. And I sort of actually imbibed that myself for a little bit until I had to deal with how life really was. And, you know, when I got my insurance physical and found out that I had fatty liver and some other things, I, like, really researched nutrition as much as I could, because at the time then and even to this day, really there aren't very good medical treatments for fatty liver. There's only lifestyle. And so I did the research and found that, no, actually saturated fat is pretty toxic and pretty horrible and leads to many of the common chronic illnesses that people in the United States suffer from. And any advice to stop limiting it is actually going to reliably kill hundreds or thousands of people simply by giving it to people. And that's been what we've seen, is, you know, essentially no drop in heart disease rates in the United States during that period of time.
Okay, most people aren't nutritionists, although some people like to sound like they're nutritionists, and they echo these sound bites that they've heard, and they're confused about what's important with food. We know that the macronutrients are protein, carbohydrate, and fat, and humans need to eat protein, carbohydrate, and fat, but people don't really know the best sources of protein, carbohydrate, and fats. We're talking about fats today, so can we talk about the good fats and the bad fats? Because we need good fat, but when people hear about saturated fat, then they think, I can't eat fat, and that's another confusing thing.
Well, you do need some amount of fat, And the amount of fat that you need is found in virtually every normal human diet. So you generally don't need to add any specific fats. But if you're going to eat fats, those fats should be polyunsaturated fats. That's well established, because those fats help reduce cholesterol rather than raising it. And cholesterol is now well established as the primary, specifically LDL cholesterol, is the primary driver of vascular disease. But you can probably get enough healthy fats from regular foods. So if your weight is healthy and you don't have any metabolic problems that you want to reverse, then eating even fatty plant foods like avocado or olives or tofu will give you more than enough of your needed fats. However, if you're overweight and you're trying to lose weight, your body has done that, put you in that situation by storing fat. And so you've stored all the fats that you ate over the last several years. And in those cases, you actually don't run any significant risk of an essential fatty acid deficiency. And in those cases, I tell people not to worry about eating fats at all, because as they lose weight, they will have plenty of available fat. And that's the majority of the patients here in the United States. That being said, saturated fats are uniquely harmful, and those you should try to limit as much as possible, regardless of your body weight. And those are the fats that come in tropical oils. Those come typically in animal products, both meat and dairy. And the sort of single biggest source of that in the United States right now is cheese.
Cheese. Let's talk about the government and cheese. Because the government, the USDA, which is supposed to be giving us guidelines on what the right foods are to eat, they're also responsible for promoting certain foods.
I think they get a little confused, right? That's right. The same government tax dollars that tell you to avoid saturated fat also pay Pizza Hut extra money to put cheese in the crust of their pizza and make deals with Burger King to increase the amount of cheeseburgers that they sell and that sort of thing.
Yeah, and send it to the school lunch program too, right?
Mm-hmm. And prisons, that's right.
And prisons.
All those places get surplus cheese that the government buys from farmers, whether there's a market for it or not, which would, of course, artificially increase the value of cheese production to a farmer and therefore result in more being produced than the economy would otherwise be able to tolerate.
I'm just wishing, I wish a lot. I mean, there are so many things that the government could do that would be so positive, and we've seen it happen in other places where there's a number of politicians that support dairy farmers, and dairy farmers are seeing a drop in market share because, for lots of reasons, and one of the reasons is there are many plant-based products now that are popular. People like the plant milks. People like the plant cheeses and the plant ice creams, which may have saturated fat in them too, but they're losing market share. And rather than coming up with something creative, like helping them transition to a different business.
Correct.
We're looking for subsidies that taxpayers will pay to keep them in business.
Right. And I think a great use of the dairy checkoff program would be to try to check farmers off growing dairy products.
Mm. I like that.
And use that money to help transition them to farming the products that customers really want. And that seems to me like a much better choice than the program that we have right now. I mean, if you lived in 1905 and your job was shoeing horses, it wasn't hard to figure out that wasn't going to be your long-term job anymore. And we really need to start thinking about these whole industries that are likely to be largely modified substantially over a period of time, and using the money that currently exists in the system to, instead of growing the market for these nearly obsolete products, to help transition people from that economic dependency to a different economic way of life where they actually are in a market that's growing.
Your book, in a little over 200 pages, covers a lot of stuff when it comes to fat. And, of course, there is a chapter on cholesterol. There's also a chapter on ceramide.
Yes.
And nobody ever talks about that. Can we talk about that?
That's my favorite chapter in the book, and it's right in the middle, just so people will have worked up to it and then have a chance to ease down, because it's probably the most obscure and the most difficult for layman to understand, but ceramide is a molecule that we recently, over the last 20 years, have been able to study in greater detail. And that's due to changes in chemical analytic techniques. And what we've found is that the things that tend to raise ceramide levels are the same sorts of things that tend to raise cholesterol levels. So that's a characteristic that's similar. But that ceramide has toxicities and has negative cellular effects that happen in a sphere entirely independent of how cholesterol works. So we know that ceramide actually is toxic to the heart muscle itself. It keeps the heart muscle from pumping correctly. We know that it's toxic to the beta cell that makes insulin in the pancreas, and we're suffering currently a giant epidemic of type 2 diabetes. And we know that it's toxic to the liver cell itself and makes the liver cell less sensitive to the insulin that the pancreas can't produce as much of because of ceramide as well, which is basically the fast track to type 2 diabetes. And we know the exact molecular mechanisms through which these things take place, and we know exactly the molecular mechanisms through which ceramide is produced, and those involve excessive consumption of saturated fat in the diet. So what's surprising is how strong the case against ceramide is and how impressive the basic research, the cell culture research, and the human study research is, and yet nobody knows about it. It's essentially an unknown molecule that only the most, the most avid biochemistry fiend would know about. It'd be easy to imagine somebody having a PhD in biochemistry and still not knowing much about ceramide. But the amount of data that's out there is quite large and quite extensive, and independent of the arguments that are related to cholesterol, argues for a diet that is incredibly low in saturated fat as a way to avoid buildup of this ceramide molecule that seems to be uniquely positioned to cause, again, most of the chronic diseases that Americans are suffering from.
So can we test for it, and should we?
So there are tests for ceramide, and they haven't yet been validated in populations that are non-diabetic enough to make it useful. I think if you have type 2 diabetes and there's a laboratory nearby that runs a ceramide level test, and you can get a baseline test, alter your diet, and then check again, that's going to give you some useful information. But, you know, in general, our malaria control efforts focus on getting rid of mosquitoes. We don't do a lot of blood tests to check for plasmodium in people who don't have malaria because it's not that useful. And so from my point of view, the ceramide control mechanism that works the best is to try to drastically limit the amount of saturated fat that people are told to eat and to try to control cholesterol, because when you're controlling cholesterol with diet and lifestyle, you're going to control ceramide at the same time.
Okay, that's fair. It's just that sometimes cholesterol numbers can be kind of confusing, so it would be nice to have another way to measure.
No, I agree. There are, you know, multiple tests that you can get of cholesterol, and they have been, again, made to seem more confusing than they really are. Really, the cholesterol number you need to know is your LDL cholesterol, and the number you want it to be under is 70, and whatever you can do to get it under that 70 is reasonable. New guidelines came out in Europe over the weekend that suggested even 50 was a better goal for people who are, you know, have type 2 diabetes or have heart disease or have other metabolic disorders. But I think for the general population here in America, who are far from 70 anyway, giving them a goal of 70 is very, very reasonable.
There are some of us, myself included, who's been a vegan for 31 years and vegetarian for about 46. And I follow, I'm a Furman fan, and I follow a nutritarian type of vegan diet for the most part. I don't cook with oil, and I don't eat processed foods and junk foods. Occasionally in a restaurant, I'll splurge.
An elevated
but
idea.
I do. But I do.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Yeah.
And
I
so I've read. Yeah, I've read about the fluffy cholesterol where it reads a higher LDL, but it's not sticking.
Yeah, that's probably a myth.
Okay. Now I'm getting nervous.
I would still try to get your LDL down. Again, there are benefits from a simply vegan diet, and there are genetic reasons that people can have high cholesterol. I have a patient myself who's suffered she's on a whole food, plant-based diet, no oils, and her LDL was 170. We just couldn't get it down.
Mm-hmm.
And in her case, we have used medication, and we just brought it down under 60. So it can be done, and I think the balance of the evidence at the moment suggests that as a vegan, your risk of vascular disease and that sort of thing is lower than the average bear at any level of cholesterol, but you shouldn't ignore high cholesterol even as someone who's entirely plant-based.
So what do I do, doctor?
Well, there's red yeast rice supplements. There are different things that you can add that can make a big difference. But if you've pretty much maxed out on nutrition, I think statin or ezetimibe are reasonable drugs to take.
Okay.
Try to get it down further.
I did have my, ApoB, apolipoprotein B, and
yeah,
that was...
apolipoprotein B is very important. So was it normal?
It was 122, which was in the standard range on the high side.
Yeah, that's high. And again, some of this is genetic. Like, there are people who have LDLs that are 220 no matter what you do, and those people have a genetic predisposition. And I think I make in the book the point that your baseline LDL is partially genetic, and there's not much you can do if that baseline LDL is really high with nutrition, but we have equations that can tell you that you can make it much worse. In other words, how you eat can make your LDL much worse than it would be from your baseline. And then if your baseline is too high, I think then medication becomes something to consider.
Hmm.
And that's something that each individual has to figure out with their physician.
Thank you. Now, you said in the book that you're not, in addition to not talking about yourself, you weren't including recipes.
Right.
But when you're talking with your patients, do you assist them in what they should be eating? Or?
Oh, yeah. We have a 7-day meal plan that we give to patients, and we have different things that we try to do. But I do really try to individualize it, and I think using a dietitian is a very reasonable and valuable step. And if your doctor's not referring you to a dietitian, you can self-refer to a dietitian, and I think that's money that's well worth spending. The number of cases of breast cancer that you want is zero. The number of cases of heart attack that you want is zero. So if lifestyle is a primary cause of any condition that you're worried about getting, then seeing a dietitian to me is money well spent. And the reason is that they can figure out what you like and then find a way for you to fit your health goals into that food system that you like. And doctors' training in nutrition is pretty poor in general. And even doctors who have a specific interest in nutrition, like myself, will not have the expertise that a dietitian would in that specific level of individualization. Now, for some people, you can tell them, just eat this food, and that's all you got to do, and that'll solve your problem. And they will eat that food if it tastes like cardboard with sriracha sauce on it.
Yeah,
it don't
right.
matter. And they'll just do it. And then for those people, a dietitian is less valuable because they just follow your instructions. But almost everybody else has significant food preferences. And getting that information from a dietitian can make a big difference.
Now, do most of your patients come to you because you're a lifestyle medicine follower, or are they surprised when you recommend them changing their diet?
Oh, I think it's a mix. I think everybody has certain expectations. And so, yeah, we get all the way from, I'm thrilled that you're actually bringing this up and nobody else that I've ever talked to has ever talked about this with me, and it's really exciting, to I'm never going to change off what I do now, like whatever I want to eat, which, and that's helpful too, because then I can just use whatever other tools we have. If the person doesn't want to do something, they're certainly not going to do it. And I found that when I, lay out the case, people's response is never really to disagree or think that the scientific evidence is not strong enough. It's just they're unwilling to make the changes or whatever. And anybody who's practiced any kind of medical care anywhere knows that there are plenty of people who just like their habits and they won't change them, as we see with nicotine or alcohol or whatever. And so what we do is try to mitigate the damage that's caused by the bad habit.
Now, part of the problem with medical doctors and nutrition is not receiving much information at the university level in nutrition. But you went to Loma Linda University, and they...
Yeah, you'd think that would have been great.
I would. Was it not?
It was pretty routine medical training. I would say we got more information on nutrition than an average school, but that's really valedictorian of summer school. I would say what I got in the basic science years pretty much went by the wayside in the clinical years anyway. And again, part of that is just the general atmosphere and milieu of medicine. You have to pass these standardized exams, and those standardized exams will want you to know certain things. And so whoever writes the exam basically gets to dictate the curriculum and gets to tell the entire medical community what's important.
And that's why there are people like...
important has not been nutrition.
Yes, but that's going to change. We have people like Dr. Michael Greger and a number of people with the American lifestyle medicine community working to get some of those important nutrition questions on the test so that they'll teach for it.
And I believe Dr. McDougall got a law passed in California that mandated a certain number of hours of nutrition training.
Yes.
For California medical schools, so I hope that gets things better there. We don't have that law in Nevada, as I found out with my medical student this morning.
Yep. Okay. Well, thank you for joining me, Dr. Evan Allen, and for writing Oversaturated. I love the title. We're oversaturated with everything, and
that's true.
It's a very meaningful title. Thanks for writing this very easy to read, easy to digest book, and I hope a lot of people read it.
Okay, thanks so much.
Okay, take care. Mm-hmm. Okay, we're going to take a little break, and that was Dr. Evan Allen, the author of Oversaturated. Let's take just a minute or so, and we'll be right back with my next guest, Jay Kuo. Hey everybody, I'm Karen Hartglass, and we are back in the second part of the program today. This is going to be fun. I'm with Jay Kuo, who is a fascinating person, and I'm going to discover more with you about how fascinating he is. He's one of these Renaissance guys. Jay is the Chief Creative Officer at The Social Edge, a digital publishing and social media company based in New York City, and he has overseen George Takei's meteoric rise on social media from its inception. Jay is the composer and lyricist for the Broadway musical Allegiance and is a producer on several Broadway shows, including, drumroll, the Tony-winning Hadestown. And if you haven't seen it, you must. okay, I don't hear you. So are we up there? I'm going to finish, and hopefully we'll get your sound there. Jay... Also, I mean, if that wasn't enough, Jay was an appellate litigator, admitted before the Ninth Circuit and the U.S. Supreme Court. He now lives in Harlem and is on a quest for wisdom, hilarity, and great veggie eats. Welcome, Jay.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, I hear you now. Okay, so here we are, and in addition to all of this, you're a vegan.
Yeah, I mean, I went plant-based about 2 years ago. And I was probably the last person any of my friends would have thought would go plant-based. and it came about because, I think in part because I was running myself completely ragged and eating poorly thinking I was enjoying life by stuffing my face with a lot of you know, heavy meats and cheeses and things. And I started to hit a wall health-wise. And I had gained something like 20 pounds in the 2 years prior. And I just chalked it up. I was like, well, I'm turning 50. I guess this is what happens to you when you turn 50. And then I went to see my doctor and I got some blood work done, and she said, oh, this is not good. And the main thing was, she said, your triglyceride levels are above 1,000.
Mm-hmm, that's high.
So I'm going to send you to a cardiologist. And I couldn't even process what was happening. I was like, wait a minute, I have a show. I've got a company. No, cardiologist? And so I went in and I got all these tests done, and they kept coming back and saying, you know, this is very serious. You need to come on for a stress test and then a calcium test, and we'll put you on this med and that med. And the meds didn't really change a lot, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And so I was getting a little bit despondent about it. And I credit my sister, who is a teacher of yoga and qigong and lives in London with her acupuncturist husband, and I've always considered them very crunchy, granola, very people of Gaia, and so, but I take her seriously because she's one of the wisest, most centered people I know, and she said, "Don't hate me, but I'm going to send you a book, and it's called How Not to Die."
Oh yeah, Dr. Greger.
Dr. Greger. Mm-hmm. I had never heard of him before. I was skeptical. But I was also a little desperate. I was not getting better. Mm-hmm. It was getting worse.
Mm-hmm.
And so I read it. I was still skeptical. First of all, mostly skeptical that I would ever be able to make a change like that. I'm like, I won't be able to. I can't live without my sausage. No way. My bacon, my cheeseburgers, my steak, chicken, everything. I'm also a foodie. Mm-hmm. Like, I cook. I love
it's
cooking.
Your identity. How could you give up all these things?
Right. And but then I said, okay, all of that or death, pick. And I said, well, I choose life.
Good.
And some amazing things happened in the first, I would say, month and a half. First of all, I dove into it like a foodie would, like I was on some sort of Iron Chef challenge. Iron Chef cucumber, you know, that's what we're going to do. We're going to do all this stuff, and we're going to figure out how to make cheese out of cashews. And, you know, and I now make really fun brie out of cashews. Mm. But I attacked it like I would any challenge. I was like, you know, I'm just going to do this, and I'm you know, it's going to be my own personal marathon. Never run a marathon in my life. Never thought I would. Never thought I would become a vegan. But I noticed some things happen really quickly. One was that I dropped weight incredibly fast. I lost 15 pounds in 4 weeks, and I was eating like crazy. Mm-hmm. I felt like I was always hungry. But I was grabbing for different kinds of food that, and I started learning things about, microbiomes and fiber and all these things. Right.
Yeah.
And it was intellectually fascinating to me, and because I had gotten to the habit of also meditating, thank you, Mimi, my sister. Mm-hmm. I was able to do these self check-ins. It's like, oh wow, I'm actually feeling different. I feel different. I don't feel as bloaty. You know, mm-hmm. I slept better. I didn't sweat all night. I took note of these things, and I blogged about it.
You don't even know sometimes all the things you're putting up with.
Exactly.
And then when they're starting to go away, I like to say you don't know how good you can feel until you do it.
Right. And I also didn't know how good some things tasted.
Mm-hmm.
Until you actually give them a chance to taste, like apart from all the things we layer in on them.
Without sugar and salt and oil?
Yeah, exactly. Covered up. I mean, they always used to play sort of second fiddle, ways to sort of augment the taste of meat. Instead, what happens if you let them take center stage? Right. And so the other thing that I started realizing is that things like my cholesterol levels came down to normal, which had never happened in my life. I always thought it was genetic.
Mm-hmm.
I always thought the reason that I had high blood pressure and high cholesterol is because my dad had high blood pressure and cholesterol, and his dad did too. But then I read something about the Green Study in China. So the Green Study in China was a massive study of, I think, 600 million people, the biggest study ever commissioned by, I think it was Deng Xiaoping. And they looked at the rates of cardiovascular disease in different parts of China, also rates of cancer. And they found there were certain green zones where the rates of cardiovascular disease were nearly negligible. And they coincided and they correlated with a diet that was low in animal protein, high in bean protein.
Mm-hmm.
High, and I looked at the map and I said, that is where my family's from.
Mm.
And then I remembered something. Granddad's dad lived to 106. Granddad's granddad lived over 100. Why did granddad only live to 76? Why did my father pass when he was 80?
Mm-hmm.
He had another 20 years with... Said, could it be because they moved to America?
Yes.
And I was staring me in the face. And then I was like, this is my body on my, what I say, my ancestors' diet.
Mm.
The green zone diet from China, where I'm eating soybean and split pea and other, and I'm finding other ways to get the protein that I thought I could only get from eggs and chicken and beef and pig.
Mm, yeah.
So that was...
I mean, unfortunately, in China, we're seeing that they're becoming more like Americans today, too, because they're eating more like us, eating dairy, which they never used to eat before, and
right.
Eating more meat as the affluence goes up. And we're seeing more cardiovascular disease, more chronic disease, and that's
a lot more, especially in the cities.
Mm-hmm.
You pair that with the air pollution and everything else. I mean, it's a problem.
Okay, so you've discovered the plant-based diet, and you're feeling better, and you're looking better, and
I'm now 24 pounds lighter.
You're lighter. You're less of yourself.
Yeah.
And I imagine, I mean, you're smart, so you must have read more things about it and maybe connected a few dots. So I'm wondering, have you connected dots between what you're eating and other things in your life? You're a musician, an artist, you composed music for Allegiance, which is a fascinating story and about exploitation and discrimination. And does that connect at all with your food choices?
Well, what's interesting is I think that moving to a plant-based diet, suddenly I think the algorithms figured out that I was now a vegan and were starting to send me things. So, you know, that's not that comforting, but they figured it out pretty quickly. And I started, and the first thing that happened was, my best friends went plant-based also.
Wonderful.
So one of my roommates, actually both my roommates went with me, changed with me. One of them has since gone back to eating chicken. But,
okay.
But
maybe
my friends,
eating more vegetables now.
Yes, definitely. And my friends who live down the street from me, we've all just been a group of friends. One of them immediately switched to veganism, saying he'd been wanting to do it. And then his partner, his husband, was saying, no, I don't think I could get enough protein. But then I sent him the book, same book, and he read it, was skeptical, but also impressed, and started doing his own research into how, you know, he's really into bodybuilding, not bodybuilding, but the really, really strong muscle mm-hmm. tone and everything. And he figured out how he could get, you know, hundreds of grams of protein from non-animal-based sources.
Have you bought him a ticket yet to the premiere of The Game Changers on September 16th?
Oh, I don't know about it. Maybe
it's a movie about amazing athletes who are on a plant-based diet. And Arnold Schwarzenegger is in it saying you don't need meat.
Right.
And it's a great film. I mean, haven't seen it. I've seen the trailers for it. But you want to take them there.
Definitely. I mean, we everybody used to say, you know, those four guys used to throw the craziest parties, you know, and you know, you really got to know them. They're really wild. And now they said, oh, those four guys are those vegans in Harlem. but we're having a moment, I think, in our friendship where we can appreciate, we all start to appreciate sort of a few things. One is you start with what impacts your own life. And that is the things that you put into your body. And all of us are very conscious of that and have always been. And then you start thinking about, well, what are the externalities of what we are doing? And whether it's, especially with things like diet and use of plastics and other things. But so we started looking into the effects of the dairy industry and the meat industry, especially beef, on things like climate change. And, of course, because we've got such a large platform, social media platform, this has now become a thing that we champion in the content that we create. We create a lot of videos for Twitter for George to share to his fan base. And
George Takei.
George Takei, right. and you know, we've written a lot, a great deal in articles and other content that he has since shared. And so we're taking sort of a look, maybe you feel like you can't give up beef fully, but cut back, mm-hmm. Do it for yourself, do it for the environment. And here are some great options. And we took it one step further. Both Lorenzo and I are entrepreneurs, and we are part of investor groups. And we like to find really cool technologies to back. And one of them is a startup that uses mushroom-based technology to start to replace beef. And we think that that is the wave of the future. We mm-hmm. think that that is the future of how humankind will eat, must eat. I always tell people, look, if you ever want to leave this planet, you aren't taking the cows, right? You're taking the plants.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
You must, yep. Right? And so we've got to think ahead. We've got to be visionary about it. We've got to support the people who are making it really smart choices and betting on the future instead of being mired in the past and stuck in their ways. People who think that they can't switch to a plant-based diet are simply wrong. They are simply wrong.
I am living proof.
I was seriously one of the biggest champions of a well-cooked steak you can mm-hmm. possibly imagine. And you know, I think that that is, and I acknowledge that there's a path for people that you have to sort of understand, starting with yourself. Because if you don't understand yourself and your own choices, whether they are dietary or moral, whether they are inclusive of your impact on the world or not, those you must start with yourself. And you know, that's been sort of the mission that I've been on, sort of not to evangelize about this really, because I don't think that's that effective.
Doesn't work.
But to set an example, and I'm constantly putting my recipes and pictures of things I create online, and people are like, you need to like make a cookbook, and I thought, oh yeah, I think I know what to call it. It's what the F do I make my vegan friends? Because a lot of people now have vegan friends, and they want to have a dinner party, and they are terrified. They don't know what to make.
Yeah, you know, I've been vegan for 31 years, and my partner Gary, who you'll meet after the program, who says he's responsible for climate change for all the meat that he's eaten, but he's a vegan for 13 years now. Mm. And said originally he could never do it. So there's many of you out there that say you can't do it, but you can do it. And we're just not invited to dinner very often. And I know it's because people are petrified. And for those of you who have invited us, thank you very much. Thank you for your courage. We are wonderful, appreciative guests. It's a funny thing, though. I was thinking about it yesterday. I lived in France for 4 years as a vegan in the early 90s, and that's when people weren't talking about veganism. They are a bit more now in France and in Europe. But my friends were really supportive, and they made food for me. They made beautiful vegetables. It was usually swimming in olive oil, but it was fine. It was lovely, and I really appreciated it. Nobody flinched. But here, I think people are less used to preparing food or preparing vegetables. I don't know what it is, but it just seems like what is vegan food? How do I do that?
Right. And because they think that a meal has to center around a slab of flesh somehow.
Yeah.
And breaking past that notion is tricky. And I think that, so I for my non-vegan friends, I start with baby steps, because I try to introduce things to them that are familiar to them, but which fool the palate. And I think that 80-90% of people would switch to more plant-based alternatives if they knew how good it actually tasted mm-hmm. and how much better it was for you. And so I take trips with my friends, and I volunteer to cook. And I will cook all vegan meals, including for my two friends down in Nashville, Tennessee, who wow. like you never would think, right? I made them scrambled, quote, eggs out of Just Egg, this product mm-hmm. that a friend of mine has introduced me to. And I used a Chinese chili paste on it. And he texted me and he got back to Nashville. He's like, I want that recipe. I liked it so much. I'm like, okay, well, you could do it with regular eggs. He's like, no, I want the just egg.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, and this is somebody who's a gigantic person, right?
Oh,
it's
yeah.
A really, really big person. And you would never think that they would want the mung bean alternative to mm-hmm. egg. But it was fresh. I thought it was fresher tasting. And I said, no dietary cholesterol. So it's possible.
That's fabulous. I know a lot of people have said when I prepared food for them, they said, if you could cook for me every day, I could do it. Yeah. So at least your friend was interested in making it for himself, which is good.
Which I think it would be very helpful. And this is my idea for this cookbook. It's just germinating. It's like if you had familiar, easy to obtain items, you say all these things are available at any Whole Foods, you know, and here's what you should buy in advance, and for a week you could cook vegan. Give it a try,
mm-hmm.
right? And you'll surprise yourself, right? And it'll be healthy for you, and you'll have given the environment a little bit of a break.
It really is easy, everybody. In 2019, it is easy. It's a lot easier than it was in 1988 when I went vegan.
And the thing is, you know, we in the West are so sort of, we treat meat so with such reverence, mm-hmm. and we actually, in some ways, we don't appreciate it because of that. So in China, meat was maybe eaten once a week, right? And they for the rest of the week, they understood that the other ingredients that they were dealing with, they had to nourish themselves, learn to nourish themselves with that. And so the standard food in the part of China where I grew up was not meat. It was simply, it was vegetables. It was And it was simple grains,
mm-hmm.
and the people were extremely healthy.
They right.
were, and sadly, China is now sort of tipped to a Western style, voracious appetite for pork and chicken and
mm-hmm.
beef.
I'm not a big fan of some of the newer products that are out there. I'm very glad they're out there, but I'm more of a Whole Foods kind of person, so I'm not like right. going nuts over Beyond Burger and Impossible Burger and all those. But some of the ones that I like are the mock meats that the Buddhist monks were making
right.
in China or in Taiwan.
Yeah,
those are amazing.
Mock duck, which is there's a restaurant in China. It's a vegetarian. I think it's called Lotus. And this is at a time when I was eating duck and things, and I went there and I was like, this is crazy good.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's not the same as duck, but it's a
is it
it's a
bean
nod,
curd
it's a
skin?
Nod toward duck. So they mm-hmm. use bean curd. There's also tempeh.
Yeah.
And you know, but it's mostly sort of soy based products, mm-hmm. right, that have been marinated and you know, the Thais are very good at this too. Whenever I want to go out to dinner with my friends and I don't want them to fuss over me, so it's good to get Thai because you can get amazing flavors, just you know, and great mock duck or tofu as your protein,
mm-hmm.
and you're not missing anything. In fact, people are often looking at my dish enviously.
That's right, because right? it's more colorful
exactly.
and more interesting.
Right.
Yeah,
more flavors.
Okay. So when we're eating plant foods, I think it opens the door to realizing, for many of us, not everyone, because some people are just focused on health, but you mentioned the environment, and our choices affect many things, and we can make really informed choices when we choose plants over animals. We're doing a good thing for the environment, for climate change, for pollution, all many, many things, and for our own health, and also for animals. And we live in a world that is very violent and very exploitive.
Yes.
So now I want to jump into your artistry, because you did this musical, Allegiance, and it's about the exploitation
yes.
and the violence. I mean, taking people out of their homes and putting them in internment camps. Does eating plant-based fit in with what motivates you in terms of your artistry?
In a way, it's all connected, because I believe that in sort of the Taoist sense that when you resort to violence, you have left wisdom. You have departed from your natural self. The natural self, according to Taoist tradition, is not violent, is not exploitative, is not angry. And, in the course of meditation, they also teach that when you're thinking about what is before you, whether it's your path or your meal, that to understand where it came from and then where it's headed, it's important that where it came from, every bite that you take can be a joy. It can be that this came from the soil, it came from the sun, it came from water, and you can be part of that cycle. Mm. Or it could come from terror. It could come from pain. And so when you realize that, when you understand that you are in a continuum, you have both a place and a connection. And if instead you are distorting that continuum, then all that flows from that, violence becomes more possible. Mm-hmm. Disconnection is more possible.
We see that so much today.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so what's the most amazing part about going plant-based was after I thought about myself, it led inevitably to thinking about others, and it led inevitably to thinking about others who are not of our species, and it led to thinking about the planet in general. And I don't think that would have been possible. Mm-hmm. And so when we're creating art, we're storytelling, right? We're telling about the human condition. And I think that great storytellers, which I aspire to be, they understand that the human condition is about being able to, artistry is about being able to connect the audience to the condition you are describing in an authentic way. That connectivity, for me as an artist, increased incredibly in the past couple of years. I'm now working on a show called Inigo. I'm the librettist, and it's about a girl who's on the autism spectrum, mm-hmm. and she's nonverbal. Mm-hmm. It will be the first musical that stars a nonverbal child on the spectrum. And through the magic of theater, she's able to sing her internal thoughts to the audience. And so it's that when you tell a story like that, you need to be able to connect. You cannot detach yourself. You need to dive fully in. And that's a challenge. It's been a huge challenge, but I don't know if I'd be up for it had I not gone down the road, which includes being plant-based, which includes studies in compassion. Mm-hmm. And
beautiful. We just have like 3 minutes left. And I wanted just to talk a little bit about Allegiance, just because I think it's an important musical. And, sure. And I think that many people do not even know what has happened in this country during World War II and what we did.
Sure. Allegiance tells a story set in World War II of the Japanese-American community. 120,000 of them moved out of the West Coast forcibly, removed from their homes, and placed into 10 different internment camps in America. Two-thirds of them were U.S. citizens. They were deprived of due process and of their property and held without charge or trial for years. And we thought when we were creating the show that we were telling a piece of our history. What we didn't know was that we would also be telling a piece of our present. And that has become so resonant now, so important, that we're actually taking the show to Japan next year at their request of in Tokyo, because I think that everyone wants to know this story. And it's quite a universal story. Unfortunately, we haven't learned its truths. We mm-hmm. haven't learned its lessons.
No.
George Takei came out and said that we are opening and running concentration camps again in America. Very controversial statement, but if you think about what we are doing, we are walking down that road because we have identified a group of people and segregated them and shut them up because of who they are.
And fear, this made-up fear.
A trumped-up mm-hmm. fear, exactly.
Trumped-up fear,
it
yeah.
was George Takei says it was a failure of political leadership that led to the internment. And here we have a political leadership that is exploiting the fear and mistrust in nativism in order to achieve political ends.
Well, I, as an American, a Native American of the United States, meaning I was born here in this country and my parents were born here and my grandparents, most of them were born here, I believe in reparations. And I believe we have a lot of apologizing to do in the United States. We need to apologize. We need to apologize to the Native American Indians. We need to apologize to those we put in slavery. We need to apologize to those that were put in internment camps. We have a lot of apologizing and reparations to do. And
yeah, I mean, I think it's the tricky thing now is, you know, we need to stop this train we're on because where it leads. You know, we talked a little bit about climate crisis. What if we can't handle tens of thousands of migrants at our border without losing our minds as a country? What are we going to do when there are millions heading north because of the carbon we put into the air?
Questions to think about. We have a lot of things to think about, and my answer for most questions is eat plants. Not animals. It's the thing you can do today. Right now, no laws need to be changed, and it's easy and delicious. We've got lots of recipes at responsibleeatingandliving.com, where I live. And I think we're going to wrap this up. So, Jay, thank you so much for joining me today, and I love everything that you're doing with the Social Edge and with your artistry.
Thanks for having me.
And with your food. I'm Karen Hartglass. You've been listening to It's All About Food. You can email me at info@realmeals.org if you have something to say. I hope you do. I love to hear from you. Thanks for joining me again, and have a delicious week.